Welcome to Holden Village. This morning in the fireside room, Albert Kruger will be teaching a session on the bequeathment of Constantinople. So let's listen in on Albert.
God, we ask the grace to be able to see the unity that you give us amidst the plurality and diversity of nations and cultures in which you place us today. Amen. It's easier to remember things if you have a picture in your mind, and you might want to pass this map around if you're not too familiar with the trends of history. This gives you the development of the Ottoman Empire over a period of centuries, just so that you'll know what part of the world we're looking at. Here's the syllabus too. And we're not going to play cards.
I wondered about that.
But here you see three very special kind of ships, and I ask you if you can see them, what they remind you of.
A ship for Columbus.
Columbus, you've got it. Okay, so that's the same time that we're talking about. And you might want to share the cards just to get your
replicas of those. Were in Corpus Christi, and we were there for an elder hospital a year ago.
Yeah. Boy, they're small, aren't they? All those little ships, they're teeny. I can't
long,
imagine.
Dark.
Yeah. So the ships...
Half a mile away was the big Lexington.
The aircraft carrier. Right.
Contrast.
Which doesn't even move in 50-foot swells. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I want to pass around some more visual images. We talked yesterday about the Hagia Sophia, the Holy Wisdom Cathedral in Constantinople, which overnight became the Hagia Sophia, the Holy Wisdom Synagogue. Mosque, the Holy Wisdom Mosque under the Ottomans, and remained that way for 500 years, and today it's a museum in Turkey. And you can, I've just marked a few pictures. There's now the museum in winter, and you can get an idea of what Constantinople looks like. I would like to live there. If I can go to Istanbul and open up a rug shop or something, I would do it. And big picture gives you an idea of the grandeur of New Rome, which was what Constantinople was. And finally, a picture of the inside today of the museum. And you see how huge. This is one of the seven architectural wonders of the world. Day from the 6th century, under the Emperor Justinian. And you see all that we talked about, icons, pictures yesterday, they've all been blacked out because Muslims don't go for that. And the calligraphy remarks about the four original caliphs are hanging there. And so you see the Muslim influence. By the way, the government of Turkey is restoring the icons in the museum. It's a secular state now, and they're beginning to not worry about that kind of thing. The irony is that the Sultan who conquered Constantinople originally also didn't worry about it. So we're kind of coming full circle. Just to get us into the present, I was looking at the magazine rack there before class, and it doesn't take too long to find contemporary questions. The Economist, there's Islam and Christianity right on the front. That's in that pen. National Geographic, Turkey. And the state of Turkey is in a difficult position now. And the Geographic says, at the crossroads of Asia and Europe, this progressive Muslim nation strives to carve out a major role in a diverse region beset by post-Cold War turmoil. In other words, now that there's no more Soviet Union, we don't need Turkey. So what are they going to do? And they have a history that's going to be determining that. See, here's a nice picture of modern-day Istanbul in the storm. So these magazines are both on the rack there. Beautiful country. By way of review, And there are issues in all of this that influence my choosing what references to use. And in the first session, to me, one of the big issues is the legitimacy of government. And we talked about the gospel commands to render under Caesar that which is Caesar's, and to be obedient to the authorities over you. And as the world changed, and Alice, you talked about the world changing, and there were times when the world just suddenly seems to become different. And we Christians kind of keep grinding along, thinking that it's still what it used to be, and we get into big trouble, and that's happened again and again. I don't know if there's anything you can do to avoid it. But there was one world, and if you rendered unto Caesar, he was in Rome. You can see Rome up there. And consequently, the Bishop of Rome, representing the church, became a very significant person, because he was at the center of power. But what happens when Caesar moves to Constantinople and the Bishop of Rome is still in Rome? Then you have a crisis. Then the bishop in Constantinople becomes the most important bishop, i.e. the patriarch of the Orthodox Church. So now we begin to have the setting of what we call the East-West split in Christianity. But it didn't originally have anything to do with Christianity. It had to do with Constantine deciding that his capital should be in Constantinople instead of in Rome. And the church adjusts somehow. And God is in all of this. Now, I'm not going to tell you how that's... We each have to kind of encounter God. So now you're a Christian and you want to render unto Caesar, but Caesar in Constantinople is constantly arguing with the Vicar of Christ in Rome. And so your sense of loyalty begins to be divided. Which, what authority do we look at? Now what happens when suddenly there's a new authority on the field? In the form of another entirely new religion that's sort of connected with yours, Islam. And now all of a sudden there's a capital of this new world in Damascus, which wasn't too far from Constantinople, ruled by caliphs who were Muslim. So what do you do if you're a Christian now? Which Caesar do you submit to? The caliph in Damascus, the Caesar in Constantinople, or the Bishop of Rome? And we develop these questions of authority, which in my mind are the biggest questions for the church today. The biggest questions. And they're the ones that cause the most conflict. But there's a history behind them and ways that we've, as a church, decided to answer them. And all of those ways are up for grabs right now. And as we look back into history, perhaps we can find some other ways that we haven't seen. That makes sense? That's why I'm here. So we have now, at this point, three different ways of understanding a Christian world and how God works with God's people. Does God work through a holy city, a holy culture? The sanctifying of a civilization, as in the Byzantine state? Or does God work through personalities, authorities, such as the Pope in Rome and the new Caesar of the Holy Roman Empire? And these two divided authorities coming into agreement and disagreement with one another. That's our heritage in the West. The Holy City is not our heritage. Or do you just do what God says and it's your job to like it? Which is a little bit of a hyperbole, but in the Muslim world, that's the national divisions in the Arab world are synthetic. And by and large, a Muslim will recognize the Muslim world over the national divisions. So you have three worlds already by the 8th century, or the 9th century. And three ways of understanding God in a holistic way. and three ways of coming to faith and making decisions and acting with integrity. The only problem is, the more you get into your way, the more alienated you're going to be from the others. And our world is getting to be very small, and the alienation is getting to be more intense. And that's our job now. That's where God has put us, is to respond in faith. So, we're going to the 15th century, and I want to let my authorities speak for themselves, if I may, because they're much better at it than I am. I'm going to be using Charles Deal again, and this is a classic study of Byzantium, greatness and decline. And I'm going to be, I recommend this, it's back on the shelves now, Lord Kinross, The Ottoman Centuries, wonderful, wonderful book, history of the Ottoman Empire. I recommended different books to the bookstore, so you won't find these there, but you can find them just about in any thorough bookstore. This one is back on the shelves. I don't recommend this. It's rather erudite, but it's good. Dino John Giannakopoulos, a Greek scholar, Constantinople and the West. And this is a study of Renaissance relationships from a very different point of view than what you and I got in our school system. Very different. Giannakopoulos. And finally, a book I didn't bring. See if I can find him. Another good book, John Julius Norwich, A History of Venice. Another major player in the Renaissance. Norwich, History of Venice. Very, very good work. And the first thing, you want to think about your history, and you want to bring to mind right now your impression of the Middle Ages. What is it?
Dark Ages.
Dark.
Church run.
Church run.
Exploration.
Exploration? Okay, I like that one.
Ferment to beginning, Hanseatically.
Okay, up north. Yeah. Along the Baltic and the...
Well, that's where the important people keep...
Well, yeah. I know where I am. Okay. Dark Ages, the beginning of what we know as modern economics in the Hanseatic League in the north, but it was also taking place in the south, and we'll look at some of that.
The issues developing trade routes to the east.
Yeah, and the explorations. Marco Polo, kind of late, really, going into this time. But there was consort with the East for centuries. It wasn't a new thing. And, mostly through the trade routes of the Middle East, which were dominated by Muslims during all these centuries. And the West always wanted to find some other way to do that, so they wouldn't be dependent on this alien largesse to get their trade done to the Far East. And that's an issue behind the ferment of the Renaissance. Yeah. Dark Ages. Now, that's almost a knee-jerk kind of thing for you and me as American citizens, but it's good to know, and really, to me, jarring, that there were no Dark Ages as such in the Byzantine world and in the Arab world. But the Dark Ages were our Dark Ages, and we do not share them. We also don't share the feudal system that we in the West have struggled against so hard. And all of the issues of authority that come out of the feudal system weren't in either the Arab world or the Byzantine world.
There were many plagues that occurred in...
Oh, lots of plagues, yeah.
Those did not occur down those parts of the world.
You don't get the plagues as seriously down south because it's a warmer, drier climate. But yeah, there were plagues, but in the Mediterranean world is, by and large, a healthier environment, I think. So that's more geography than anything else. But there were plagues in Constantinople from time to time.
Question on your map, what does Mystra mean, or why is that there?
Well, we're going to get into that.
Good.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite towns of all time. And if you're a romantic, I want to visit Mystra, and live there and drink ouzo. Yeah. And not have any responsibilities. That's my goal in life. But our heritage, you see Paris up there, and that should bring to mind Thomas Aquinas. And we're back in the Dark Ages, and the great Thomas Aquinas blending philosophy and religion and shaking up everybody and being threatened by the Inquisition. Aristotle was the philosopher. He used in the 13th century. Well, where did he get Aristotle? Yeah, from the Arabs in Cordova. Cordova for hundreds of years in what's now Spain was the primary center of learning in the Muslim world. The primary center of learning. High culture.
It's interesting that it's so far west. You'd think they would have had something in Damascus. Or...
They did, early, yeah. The trend in the Arab world, Damascus originally was the center, and then during the high Middle Ages, Baghdad was the center of the Muslim world, and that's where all your romantic images of the flying carpets and things come from. And Constantinople was the major city in the Christian world, and there was not much going on anywhere else. But the Mongols kind of took care of Baghdad and the Turks, and so your Arab strength was in Spain. That's really kind of how that came about. We won't get into the Mongols today. We'll look at them Thursday a little bit. Yeah. So the Greek philosophy and kind of leaked into the West. But from where? From the Arab world. And I want to read from Charles Deal here. The Arabs themselves owed much to Byzantium. Now, Byzantium, you don't... By and large, and this to me is an outrage in our school histories and undergraduate histories, by and large, the history of Byzantium, which is a 1,000-year history, is taken care of in a sentence or a paragraph. Nothing happened, and it's not worth looking at. Okay, and then we move along. And it's wrong. When in the 7th century the Muslims conquered Syria and Mesopotamia, great schools were flourishing in Antioch, Edessa, Nisibis, and Haran, and the masters who taught them were steeped in Greek culture, in Aristotelian philosophy, and ancient medicine. The Umayyad caliphs applied to them for translations into Syriac and Arabic of the most important Greek and Byzantine works. The Abbasids in Baghdad were equally eager to collect Greek manuscripts and obtain translations of the most famous works of Greek science, medicine, and philosophy. Throughout the 9th century, now think about it, what's going on in Western Europe during this time? Nothing. Throughout the 9th century, scholars in Baghdad were busy translating Euclid, Archimedes, Ptolemy, Dioscorides, Hippocrates, Galen, Aristotle, and Theophrastus. And it has been justly said that but for Byzantium and the Byzantine traditions communicated to them by the schools of Syria, the Arabs, for all their brilliant gifts, would have remained what they were in the days of Muhammad, that is to say, semi-barbarians. It was through the Syrian translators that they learned the science and philosophy of Greece, and it was thanks to them that a great and fruitful intellectual movement arose throughout Islam, from Spain to India. Lastly, it was through the Arab schools in Cordova that the Christian West came to know Aristotle, and in this roundabout manner, scholasticism owes its origin in part to Byzantium.
But only being translated by the Arabs.
By the Arabs. And so the West received Greek philosophy through Arab influences.
Certainly the reason why the early Christian cultures didn't pick up on those earlier writings.
the early Christian culture did. The Greeks never lost it. See, Byzantium was always there, and it never left. It was in the West, and this constant arguing between Rome and Constantinople.
So they were
that caused the Greeks.
Present in Constantinople.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah.
Well, then, when did Rome and Byzantium stop talking to each other? Is there? I mean, I remember 1057.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that, but they stopped talking with any intent to communicate long before that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like, and essentially, I think the real historic breach was the creation of the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, if the Pope in Rome creates another Christian empire and consecrates another Caesar, that's a pretty definite breach with the old Roman Empire and the old Caesar. That was in 800. Yeah.
But that act of hostility by the Roman Empire against Constantinople essentially locked out the ancient Greek knowledge from...
What was going on in Byzantium became evil in their eyes, just to put it bluntly. Whatever it was.
That's fascinating. Never thought of it that way.
Yeah. And that includes all the Greek heritage of Byzantium. And that sets the stage for the later struggle in the Renaissance and the Reformation, for centuries considering all that stuff to be evil and building a culture around it. Let's look at deals and all. Other things came to the West from Byzantium, strange as it may seem, considering the hostility that existed between the Greek and Roman churches, the unquestioned superiority of Byzantine theology up to the 12th century gave the Eastern Church a certain ascendancy over that of the West. Scotist Erigena in the 9th century translated Dionysius the Areopagite and Maximus the Confessor. Peter Lombard and St. Thomas Aquinas were inspired by John of Damascus.
But again, via the Arabs.
Via the Arabs. The mediators of Greek culture. We owe a lot to Arab culture. Just a lot. And the one example I like to use is algebra, which is an Arab word, algebra. And the whole foundations of mathematics were developed in the Arab world.
I had a teacher who liked to point out that toothpaste, the fork, and most table manners come from the Arab world.
Right. If it wasn't for Byzantium in the Arab world, we would still be wallowing in disease and sickness as Western Europeans, basically. So... There's something to be said for the study of history. Now, something happens in between the 9th century and the 15th century. The West, you all probably know more about the West than I do, so I'll let you just think about what you've learned. But in the East... invasions from the steppes of Central Asia. And first the Turks invade and they overrun the Arab world in the Middle East. And they're halted in Egypt. So North Africa remains Arab Muslim. The rest of the Middle East is dominated by the Turks, a new race.
What religious character?
Turks were the polytheists, but they quickly absorbed and took on Islam as their faith and established themselves in Baghdad.
And what area did they come from?
What's now Mongolia and Kazakhstan and areas in Central Asia. Yeah, which is still Turkish now, ethnically, and has been all along. But up until this time, what we know now as Turkey was Greek for centuries, 1,000 years, more than that. Greek. That's where they lived. Not just in what we now know as the Greek Peninsula, but Asia Minor as well. That was the Greek world, and it was Byzantium, which was the Greek Christian state, and the capital in Constantinople. Turks overrun the Arabs. And they do well for a while, but then Genghis Khan arrives, and that takes care of the Turks. I'm covering a lot of ground here. We'll look at Genghis closer in a couple of days. Not too much lasting there, but one branch of the Seljuk Turks ends up right here. The family name of Osman, which becomes the Ottoman Empire. And they're pressed up against between the Mongols and the Byzantine Christians. And they are Muslims. The Mongols kind of didn't, they were very transitive and transient rulers. So Islam remains in the Far East. What happens now? This little Turkish unit here had already become known in the Turkish Muslim world as the Sultanate of Rum. Rum in Arabic meaning Rome. Rome. And the tradition, this is just coming out of the culture, of Turkish culture, was that they were the inheritors of the grandeur that was Rome. The grandeur and the call of empire has never left the Mediterranean world from the days of Caesar all the way through Mussolini. And the Turks began to take it on. And as the Turks begin to take it on and begin to see themselves as the people who are to inherit the authority of Caesar, and if you're a Christian in that area and you're reading your Bible, it says, render unto Caesar, you've got a few more questions to ask. Just a few more. And that's, God doesn't let us rest. I was thinking about the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. You just, the minute you get it figured out, something comes and just messes up the works.
In that case, Caesar was the head of another religious culture.
Yeah, entirely different race, different culture, different religion.
Different language.
But the same ancient tradition. Politically. Really, so the Turks are there. In the meantime, the Byzantines still call themselves the Romans. And the Turks eventually, the West tries to neutralize Byzantium. And part of the tragedy of this conflict between East and West is that the Byzantines eventually get reduced to just a little bit around Constantinople, a little bit over here in what was called Trebizond, and a little bit in what was ancient Sparta. And the center of that is a little town called Mystra. And that's it. That was the Orthodox world. Because the Ottomans, after the Mongols left, took over all what used to be the Arab world over here, and they began to cross into Europe. And their eyes were on Europe, not on the East. They desired to be a part of the European world. And they established their capital at Adrianople, which is a hop, skip, and a jump from Constantinople. And sort of just at the beginning of the Renaissance, then you have the Ottoman Turks living within earshot, practically, of the Byzantine, the ancient capital of Rome. And they are surrounded. Is that clear? I want to make sure you know what's going on here, because we're getting into the 15th century.
What year did the Ottoman Turks
over that area? It was in just the previous century. They were moving fast.
So it was 14th?
Yeah.
14th century?
Yeah. And you can see by the map how much they eventually took over. And of course, we know historically they conquered all the way up to the gates of Venice. And then we begin to involve Polish and German and Austrian history in the Ottoman Empire. And we're seeing the remains of that in Yugoslavia. Today.
Well, even during the Reformation, Luther was talking about the Turks were invading Germany.
Yeah. This is part of the pressure on Martin Luther up in Germany. The heathens are right. You could walk over and talk to them. Understand, this is a Western attitude. This is a Western attitude. In the East, this kind of hostility was not the norm between Christians and Muslims. Because they had to learn to live, Christians and Muslims and Jews, together under Muslim domination for centuries. That hostility was not a part of their inheritance. And if we're going to understand our own Reformation and Renaissance, we have to, I think, and that's a soapbox I'm on, to understand that it's our hostility, it's not universal. To help, I don't want to get all worked up here. So the Turks are there, and they are very bright and very ambitious and have a broad view of what life is all about, and they surround Constantinople with the intention in the long run of taking it and becoming the new Roman Empire. And it was an intentional Ottoman plan. In the meantime, in the West, the Republic of Venice, new things are coming up, and the Italian republics are beginning to form and to antagonize the church as well, and that's part of our history. And Venice, you'll see a picture here that's very important. If your eyes are good, you can see what this is.
Venetian worship.
Well, yeah, it's, and what is it?
Galley.
It's a galley, yeah, and a galley is a ship that does well close to shore, has lots of strong galley slaves rowing it, and it does have a sail, but that's not its primary means of propulsion. And the galley for 1,000 years was the means of transportation throughout the Mediterranean world. It was the best way to get from point A to point B. And the Venetians relied on the galley, and they lived on an island protected entirely from any land forces that could threaten them. They didn't have to worry about that at all for hundreds of years. And they were the ones with the fleet. Genoa over here had a fleet, but Venice was the dominating power in the Eastern Mediterranean because of the galley. And they became what? This is a blank, multiple choice test.
Rich.
Rich, you got it, see? Now, soapbox number two. What are the foundational values of a culture? And soapbox number 386. We have foundational values in Constantinople, like it or not. The holy city, God divinizing the polis. We have values in the Arab world, which is obedience to God. We have chaos in the West. And the strong power turns out to be one based on greed. Do I get a response there?
Yes. Where are you today?
Yes, this is the foundations of the modern world that you and I are formed by. We can't get away from it. A new value system is coming into being, and it works very well.
For those who agree.
Yes, and everybody else notices how well it works, and they imitate it. Venice. Constantinople is the golden city of history. For 1,000 years, the monetary unit of the Byzantine Empire was a stabilizing influence throughout the entire world. All the way to China. For 1,000 years. This is called stability.
It was never overrun in finding power.
Not for 1,000 years.
Not for 1,000 years. This is what we write off in our history.
That rates a sentence.
Rates a sentence, yeah. Now, Venice is very interested in it, and they establish themselves. Venice and Genoa become what we might call today the most favored nations of Constantinople, and they begin milking the city for all it's worth. What is going on in Constantinople? In the West, in the ignorant West, I think we... The role of Constantinople has been greater than is easy to grasp. And one little story that just leaped out at me was the story of one of the emperors of Byzantium who was ready to get married. And how did he find his wife? He sent his courtiers out. This literally happened. To all the cities and towns of the Byzantine Empire, looking for the most beautiful and intelligent, eligible woman.
Did he have a glass slipper?
Well, the glass slipper I didn't see, but I looked at that and I thought, now I know where Cinderella comes from. Over in the East, as people travel back and forth and brought back stories of this great city, and they began to envy it, and they began to want what that city had, but they weren't willing to make the commitments that provided for the foundation and the stability of that great world, which lasted for 1,000 years, and which we have lost. So Venice is established in Constantinople, and Venice is making money, and they are using their galleys well. Now, the Crusades illustrate this issue. And I'm not really interested in the Crusades because I've failed to find any historic value from them whatsoever except to increase the hostility. But the Fourth Crusade is interesting because it was supposed to be a crusade against the Turks, and it was sponsored in part by Venice. When the Crusaders got there, they decided they'd rather go after Constantinople instead and get the money. Look at what Norwich says. Not since the barbarian invasion some seven centuries before had Europe witnessed such an orgy of brutality and vandalism as in the Fourth Crusade. Never in history had so much beauty, so much superb craftsmanship been wantonly destroyed in so short a space of time. It was Constantinople's darkest hour. The Norman and Venetian invaders destroyed the city in an orgy of looting and vandalism, and established a Western empire there which lasted little less than a generation. That empire was overthrown by the Palaiologan dynasty, which recovered Constantinople and remained in power until the Turks conquered it. And that's basically the dynasty that is in power in the early Renaissance.
What year was that?
The Fourth Crusade was the 13th century, 1204. So we're just kind of leaping back a little bit, but just to give you the environment there between East and West, which was not friendly.
Why did the Venetians support the Crusades?
Oh, money.
Against the Turks. To extract the wealth of
the country. The Venetians got wealthy on the markets in the Eastern Mediterranean and farther east. That's their livelihood. And Constantinople is the main town. That's all you need to know, really.
You could use a church-sanctified vehicle.
Yeah. And in the meantime, Rome, of course, is playing Venice off against the Holy Roman Empire and the Arabs and all of this manipulating that we know as Western history and take for granted. That's our heritage.
Was Venice under the control of the Roman Church?
Venice wasn't under the control of anybody.
They were the controller.
They were absolutely independent. And they used their independence well. They were had some affection for Byzantine Orthodox culture in Venice, probably more than for the West.
Yeah. But when they went to church, they went to what we would call a Catholic.
Yeah, they went to a Latin church. Right. Okay, so we've got the Turks and the Venetians with their galleys and the Crusades and the bad memories. 1453 is our date. We're going into the Renaissance. Now you have another picture. What's that? Now, what is our inheritance from the Middle Ages in terms of warfare?
Gunpowder.
Not from the Middle Ages.
Castles then?
Castles.
Yeah, this was the downfall of castles.
This definitely was the downfall of castles. And who was the one that first used cannons in the way we know them?
The Ottoman Turks.
Yep, and he is known as Mehmet II, Mehmet the Conqueror, whose life ambition was to capture Constantinople. And the way he did it was by contracting in a way that no other country in the world could because of the expense. An 8-inch cannon, among other things, which the likes of which had not been seen before, to pound away on the 40-foot walls of Constantinople day after day until there was nothing left. And you set the stage for the modern world with the Ottoman Empire. The last emperor is a subject of great romantic feeling. Constantine the 11th was resident in Mystra when the Turks surrounded Constantinople. Constantinople called on the Venetians for help with their navy. The emperor, out of a sense of duty and mission, intentionally went to Constantinople to prepare the defense. And Emperor Constantine the 11th died defending the walls of the city. And that was the end of 1,000 years of Byzantine history as the Turks poured in. Now, what's going on in Constantinople? Now we read from Lord Kinross on the role of the Venetians. Not Lord Kinross, Norwich. He's over here. He's the one that told us about the Crusade. This is the history of Venice, Norwich. The Venetian armada was to come to the rescue of Constantinople. There was also a Turkish armada, but the Venetians were much better at it than the Turks and eventually defeated them, and that will be the end of our discussion today. But they were to come to the rescue of the Byzantine state. They claimed that weather kept them from getting there, which I've always found peculiar because the galleys don't depend on weather. You row the galleys. The wind, unless it's a hurricane, like with Paul in his journey to Rome. But they don't get there. In fact, they just get there a little bit too late. In the meantime, the Ottoman Turks are very clever. And on the north side of the Golden Horn, where the Genoan colony is, who also, of course, are in perpetual conflict with Venice for markets in the east, they can't get through into the Golden Horn, the main harbor, because the Greeks have it blocked off. So they build a road behind the Genoan colony, create great rollers, and they roll their fleet up over the hill behind Galata and into the Golden Horn from land. They pull their whole fleet into the main harbor of Constantinople, and that is the beginning of the end of the city. Well, the Genoans, of course, oh, is there something going on behind us? This is a whole fleet of galleys going overland on rollers. They didn't have a chance. Constantinople, by that time, with the guns on one side and the Venetian fleet holding back. It is significant that Loredan, the admiral of the Venetian fleet, was carrying on board his flagship an ambassador to the Sultan. Whose instructions provided for the possibility of the siege being over by the time of his arrival. We are left with the conclusion that the Venetians were pursuing a policy of festina lente, which I don't know, but been in retailing, so I have some ideas. They wished the world to believe that they were sending a great relief armada to save Eastern Christendom, and they did their best without much success to encourage the princes of Europe to do likewise, but their hearts were not in it. They were realists enough to know that the Byzantine Empire was doomed, and they had no wish, needlessly, to antagonize its Ottoman successor. In Mehmet's friendship, the Ottoman Sultan, They saw not just the best means of assuring the continuation of profitable trading with the Orient, but in all probability the only chance of retaining their own colonies in Greece and the Aegean. If Venice did not come to the relief of Constantinople in time, it is because she had no real desire to do so. They wrote it off. And a new value system is seen to work fine. Thank you, John Julian Norwich. Now, the Sultan is in Constantinople and the Hagia Sophia becomes the Hagia Sophia, and Istanbul becomes the center of the Muslim world for the next 500 years and becomes a major player in the Renaissance in Europe, a center of culture and learning under Suleiman the Magnificent, who is the second successor of Mehmet the Conqueror, a major player. In the meantime, what is going on in Mystra and Constantinople? The Greek scholars have gathered in these two cities, and they are beginning to consort with the Florentine scholars and the Pavlan scholars and the other new schools in Venice. And they begin to transmit and entrench themselves in the Florentine system. And we're going to read from Gaianopolis here for a minute about the Greek scholars and their role in the Renaissance. As for the Byzantine emigres, they found the Italian intellectual terrain well prepared for them because the Italian humanist focus on the studia humanitatis is very similar to the rhetorical training so fundamental to the Palaeologan Renaissance, which had been taking place for several hundred years. What we know as humanism was a way of life in the Byzantine world, a Christian world. P.O. Christeller has astutely remarked that the learning and interests of the Italian humanists had more links to the Byzantine didactic tradition than to their Western predecessors, the Scholastics. And we move on. The figure whose appearance in Florence helped most to reorient Florentine humanism away from its primarily rhetorical emphasis was not Pletho, but the Byzantine professor John Argyropoulos, who later occupied a chair in Greek philosophy at the Florentine Studium from 1456 to 1471. It was during his teaching tenure that the Florentines began, for the first time, I believe, fully to understand what Pletho had spoken about, and especially, as E. Guerin maintains, to view Greek learning in the total context of ancient Greek philosophy and civilization. Ironically, Argyropoulos had taught in Constantinople at the higher school called the Catholicon Museion, was brought to Florence by several young Florentine Aristotelians in order to expound not Plato but Aristotle. In the morning, Argyropoulos publicly taught and interpreted Aristotle's writing on natural science, notably physics, and on his metaphysics, ethics, and other subjects. In the afternoon, however, in his own home, and to a select group of students, he expounded on the philosophical and theological doctrines of Plato, on the Pythagoreans, on the Chaldaic oracles, and on the various Neoplatonic successor schools. So deep an impression did his Platonic teaching make that Argyropoulos deserves primary credit for the shift in the focus of Florentine humanism from rhetoric, eloquence, to metaphysical philosophy, particularly Platonism. His emphasis on understanding Plato as well as Aristotle was undoubtedly an expression of Palaeologan interest in both philosophers, reflecting also his Byzantine sense of the wholeness of culture. He taught Greek philosophy as a developing organic unity, beginning with the pre-Socratics, the Pythagoreans, and Orpheus, and proceeding systematically to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and its successors. And as a person holding a degree in philosophy, that's the way it's taught still. Oh, those were the ruling family in Constantinople. The Palaeologan family, dynasty.
Oh, that's the name of it.
Yeah.
This implies that the Turks conquered Constantinople, didn't destroy the scholarship that existed.
Not at all.
People immigrated from.
Yeah. In fact, it was Mehmet the Conqueror's intention, which he carried through, to simply take over what was Byzantine tradition and encourage it to continue. And he appointed a patriarch and gave the patriarch virtually absolute authority over the Christian world in the Ottoman Empire.
Does that still exist?
Well, Turkey's a different country now.
Yes, but yeah. I mean, is there still a sense of getting along with Christians in Istanbul?
Yeah. Manuscripts of Herodotus and Thucydides, the leading Greek historians, were also brought in by Byzantines in this period. Herodotus first becoming known in Latin translation through the version made by Perrate, secretary of the Byzantine cardinal Bessarion, and later by Lorenzo Valla. Thucydides became available again through Valla's translation in 1450, just before the fall of Constantinople. It is impossible to gauge the impact of Thucydides on Italian humanism, but his powers of historical analysis, objectivity, and the rhetorical excellence of the speeches included would have impressed any humanist. In particular, Valla, whose acute awareness of the importance of historical criteria for evaluating documents permits historians to call him the father of modern historical criticism and of critical philology as well. All this is coming through the Eastern Roman Empire and the culture that they maintained all along, not in secret, but it was a part of their daily life. Virtually, I mean, not virtually, literally, unknown in the West in the Dark Ages. And it all went in a flash because of Venetian greed. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this is what becomes what we live for in the West. And I don't know about you, but I don't like it.
One thing interesting in this is that you're talking about foundational values. We have the Orthodox in the East and the money of Venice. We haven't talked too much about any foundational values coming out of Rome or the Western Church.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that. Yeah.
Well, but I'm getting.
I'm being antagonistic.
That's fine, but yeah. I'm getting a sense that we can see in our own culture values other than what's coming out of the Western Church.
Yeah, we can. Yeah. And this is a little simplified, but the fact is we leave out, I don't recall any acknowledgement that Byzantine influence even existed, let alone that it was as valuable as it really was. And when we ask our questions about church and state and get all worked up about that, we fail to recognize that church and state existed side by side for 1,000 years in Constantinople, providing stability for the entire world, but not on a form that we even understand. But it's gone, and I don't think it'll come back. Now, we end, and let's end on the new thing that's happening, because Venice, God gets Venice. We want to bring God back into this. There's another picture here. That's the one on the playing cards. In 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella complete the liberation of Spain. The Muslims are out. In the same year, they commission Columbus to sail in this new kind of ship, the galleon, or the littler sailing vessels, which depends on wind instead of oars.
Now, it has people on it.
Yeah. It does have people on it. Yeah.
But less people.
Less people, yeah. And it's faster and more maneuverable. And it also can go across open sea. And it can weather storms. So after all of this investment on Venice with its reliance on galleys, after all the tragedy in Constantinople, who is on the rise? Spain. Because they have galleys. And they are going all over the world in the galleys. Columbus was a Genoan, and he went to Venice to ask if they would sponsor him. And they said, Hey, that's insane. We know how to make money, and we're not going to invest in this craziness.
Well, there's a conflict of interest probably to sponsor a sailing vessel and monopolize trade through their galleys.
Not only that, but they were trying very hard to be friendly to the Sultan. And it would not be good for them to say, we want to establish trade with you while they're building sailing vessels to circumvent the Sultan, which is precisely what this was for.
And driving the Turks out of Muslims out of Spain.
Yeah, so the Venetians were hoisted on their own petards, as they say. And we will end with a quote from Norwich. The year 1492 marked a turning point in the history of the West. It was the year of Columbus' discovery of the New World and the year in which his patrons Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile finally defeated the Moorish kingdom of Granada. It saw in Florence the death of Lorenzo the Magnificent, who, despite his lifelong mistrust of Venice, had done more than any other single man to promote and, whenever possible, to preserve Italian solidarity against French ambitions. France is coming in. And in Rome, after the most corrupt election in papal history, the accession of its most immoral pontiff. Many Catholics in there. This is Norwich. I don't know what faith he is, but anyway. If we exclude Antipope John the 23rd, since the days of pornocracy nearly 6 centuries before, Rodrigo Borgia, henceforth to be known as Pope Alexander the 6th. And who comes up against him? Come on, Lutherans. Martin Luther. It was pretty bad. But this is the prelude to all of that.
And all those architects building those